like the phases of the moon.
Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Tuesday. It's the 16th of April, and we welcome you to the program. Very happy that you're with us. It is just simply a beautiful day outside, and hopefully we'll maybe you can enjoy both us and the beautiful day at the same time. And if not, you can at a certain point today get out and enjoy. It is it's just lovely. At least it is here. I assume you came from the southern region, and it was lovely.
Yeah, beautiful down in the Catskills. Beautiful drive up here.
You came from the north.
Glorious day.
Yeah. So okay, I think we got our bases covered. We're pretty good.
I drove 4 blocks. This is pretty much the same climate.
Yeah, you probably had the most dangerous ride in. It's very nice to have you all here. Thank you very much for being with us. And we've got a bunch of stuff to discuss, so let's get to it. I just want to make a quick note, and it's no other reason. It's just because I'm having trouble. I went to see Bruce Springsteen last night, which was great. The concert was great. And my goodness, he's amazing. At some point in the frivolity, I lost my glasses. I don't know when, but I remember seeing Bruce in the last song. So somewhere from there in the car. Baby, I Was Born to Run, however, not when you don't know where you're going. And I just was like, oh, that's a curb. So I have cheaters that I found, my wife's cheaters, in the car. And that's what I'm using. So if things that I say just don't make sense today, you know,
blame it on the glasses.
Unlike most days. Yeah, I'm going to blame it on the glasses. Because there's one focal point where I can see, and the rest of it is just gauze.
So yeah. If everybody could use large fonts on their letters, all caps.
Yeah, I mean, I'll be honest, Jay. I've got enough large font on every device I have. But also, if you're around the arena and you see a pair of Nike sports specs, hey, pick them up. Get in touch with me. I'd love to be reunited with them. Okay, let me introduce everybody. Diplomat in residence at Bard College, Ambassador Fred Hoff joins us. Good morning, Fred. How are you?
Yeah, good morning, Joe. Happy to be with you this morning.
Very nice to have you here. Jim Ketterer is back, Senior Fellow, Bard Center for Civic Engagement. Good morning, Jim. Nice to have you back.
Good morning. Happy to be here.
2 days in a row. We lucked out. Semi-retired editor-at-large, columnist, editorial writer from the Times Union newspaper, Jay Jochnowitz. Hello, cool. Jay.
Hi. How are you? We went through that, actually.
Yeah. Yeah, it was too long of an answer for everyone. But yes, I'm fine. And Vice President for Editorial Development at the New York Press Association, Judy Patrick. Hello, Judy. How are you?
I am fine, but can I do one brief rant, and then I'll be done?
Yeah.
I was watching the WNBA. Caitlin Clark was the number one draft pick. Do you know how much she makes her contract for first year? Let me first say that the number one NBA draft pick gets $10 million a year. Her salary first year, $76,000.
Oh, enough.
If I'm wrong, let me know. But I searched high and low to try to find something better than that. But that is what, and I think she goes up to 78 next year, maybe into the 80s and the 30s.
And in either case, NBA or WNBA, that does not include endorsement deals, which good for her, but you should still have the base salary,
mm-hmm. Right?
Which would be, what was it, 30 million people watched that final game? I mean, or 28, yeah. Something like that. I mean,
that's a phenomenon.
That's money in the bank. And this is how naive I am. When I heard they were talking during the tournament, I said, they said, you know, the top salary would be what you just, 70 whatever thousand dollars. And I said, well, I'm sure that won't be the case for her. I guess that's wrong.
I bet it won't be the case for long. I think when she has her first season and she and Angel Reese and there's some more great players coming in. I think the WNBA is on the edge of just being really transformed.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, and hopefully they can actually get what the, because somebody's making money off of that.
Oh yeah,
somebody's making a lot of money off that, and it's not the players. So, I also want to mention that Judy's going to be part of our Friday panel. We're having a special live at the Linda on Friday morning from 9 to 11. And we're just going to be talking about a whole bunch of things going on. We have, with the exception of yours truly, we have a an all-female panel. And it's a great, great list of really fantastic, smart, amazing women who will be with us on Friday morning. Judy Patrick will be there, and we are very, very excited. Also on the docket, Judith Henk, Vera Karius-Kelly, Sienna Freeman-Tolbert, Libby Post, Nick Rangel, Sarah Rogerson. So we're going to talk about everything. And you are more than welcome to join us. It is a fundraiser for the station. Just go to WAMC.org, WAMC.org, and you can see, I believe it's $75 contribution, and you can get in to see us. Breakfast will be served, and it should be a really fun time. We enjoy these events. And the thing that's always surprises me is when I ask the question at the beginning, how many of you have never been to one of these events? And more than half raised their hands. And that's just amazing to me. I just figured it was the same 200 people. I'm glad it isn't, but that's great. So,
and the breakfast is usually pretty good, too.
Oh, yeah. Yes. Yeah. I think Healthy Cafe. Yeah. It's great. Oh, no, it's great. It really is good. And we all get to mingle, and we get to talk, and we take a lot of selfies, and we have fun, and we go out in the audience, and I have a microphone, and I get to talk to people, and maybe by then I'll be able to see. It'll be great. It'll be really, really great. WAMC.org to find out more information. We'd love to have you in the audience. And here's the thing. People always say to us, oh, you ought to do this more often. Okay, well, we are, so support it, and we'll make it so, and it should be a really, really good time. We welcome you, and we thank you for all of your support in these live broadcasts. And it's at the Linda. I should have mentioned that. It's at the Linda, so it's a beautiful venue, and I just think we're going to have a very, very good time.
Right. Parking is easy.
That's right. That's right. Parking is sort of easy. I haven't introduced anyone, have I, yet?
Yes.
Yeah, you did. Yeah. You did.
Did I do everybody?
Yeah, I was last, as usual. Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Shall be first.
Well, you can see how this day is going to go. Okay. good morning, and thank you very much for being with us. A delight. Let's get started and talk about what's happening in the news today. The trial of Donald Trump started yesterday, and it was a rousing success. They did not pick a single juror, and that was what they were there for yesterday, was to jury selection. Well, that didn't happen. And while he faces charges that he falsified business records to cover up a sex scandal while serving as president, more than half of the first group of prospective jurors was dismissed almost immediately for a variety of reasons. Now, as far as let us remember that Mr. Trump faces 34 felony counts and could face probation or up to 4 years of prison time. The trial is expected to last weeks. That's when it actually gets underway. Because first, a jury must be selected, a winnowing that began Friday. There's a couple takeaways that the New York Times published that I thought are interesting, just to maybe start off on the conversation. Justice Merchant, a veteran New York jurist, is no nonsense. That hasn't favored the defense. He's been consistent about batting back defense motions on issues, including the tardy disclosure of documents by prosecutors and efforts to delay or even dismiss the case. Also, the trial is about much more than business records. Justice Merchant's decision on Monday made it clear that the trial will resurface unsavory events in the former president's life. Those include the Access Hollywood tape and other stories that Mr. Trump sought to suppress, including an alleged affair with Ms. McDougal. And Justice Merchant said on Monday that both could be discussed. Meanwhile, Trump says he's happy, although his demeanor suggests otherwise. Entering the courtroom, he said he was very proud to be there. Once he was in front of Mr. Merchant, Trump looked a lot less enthusiastic. He slouched, he scowled, he scoffed, and he was quiet. Not the norm for a man who has built a political career with his gift for slashing attacks and vicious put downs. And yes, at one point before lunch, he appeared to fall asleep. The trial may take a while. That's another takeaway. It's easy to forget how long it takes to do a little in legal settings. On Monday, the morning session was dominated by maneuvering by prosecutors and the defense. Even as prospective jurors waited, by lunch they were still waiting. Jury selection could take days or weeks, and the trial itself may take months. The Passover holiday could cause delays, Justice Merchant said, though he might make some of that up by holding hearings on court matters on Wednesdays, which previously was going to be an off day. And so now, as of yesterday afternoon, prospective jurors finally made their way into the courtroom. The judge welcomed them, introduced the lawyers and Mr. Trump, and read them a summary of the case. And these are the questions. He asks, and if anyone has ever served in a jury knows these very well, can you be fair and impartial, especially to the former president? Of the 96 prospective jurors in the room at the time, more than 50 raised their hands. They were immediately excused. The remaining jurors were asked 42 questions. By the end of Monday, 11 jurors had been questioned and two more were excused. A woman who said she could not be fair and a man who said his child's wedding date could conflict with the trial were both let off. And then to round it all out, Trump spoke briefly to TV cameras after court adjourned. And he called this, he's doing something new now, he called it a political witch hunt.
Wow, yeah. I heard those words.
Yeah. And then he went to the motorcade and went off, and I assume we'll be back at the courthouse today. All right. Judy.
So I understand the intense media coverage yesterday. There was a lot of it. It was almost relentless. And as someone who sat through, as a reporter, a lot of jury selection, it can be fairly interesting because both sides kind of lay out their cases. They interview witnesses. They haven't gotten to that point. Be interesting to see what happens today because this can quickly grind down to boring. I can almost understand Donald Trump nodding off. It's interesting that at the end of the day, one of the top things the Trump team tried to dispel or to counter was the idea that he had fallen asleep. He had not fallen asleep, as people say. People misinterpreted that. But people who saw it in the courtroom seemed to think his mouth went slack. He had that jerk you get when you're sitting up and you realize you're asleep. So I can understand he might have fallen asleep. There's one thing people should understand here, though, that Democrats and people who are against Donald Trump are breathlessly waiting for this trial. There is a possibility that he will be exonerated, that he will be found acquitted, and that will only bolster his chances for re-election. I don't think that's talked about enough. People who are clamoring for these trials to go forward, there's a chance that he could be, that they could get a hung jury, they could get a jury that fails to convict. So that would be even better for him.
Jay.
My first thought when I saw that they didn't pick any jurors was I was kind of encouraged by it that people are answering honestly. And the next thought that occurred to me is that, as soon as jurors start getting picked, Donald Trump is going to say they're dishonest. If that's not a violation of his gag order, if it is, and he doesn't care, I don't know. It's encouraging to know that people are willing to go into court and say, no, I can't be objective, which is kind of the opposite of a rigged system that, it would be liberals clamoring to get into court and walking in and going, oh, no, I could judge this just fine. I'll find him guilty through all the evidence for sure. It's an encouraging thing to see that people are being honest, although it wouldn't be the first time people were dishonest to get out of jury duty either. So, but anyway.
I'm all for jury duty, but you have to, I would have to say, to get involved in that nonsense,
mm-hmm.
I mean,
well, and fear. My wife pointed that out. That you know anybody on that jury is probably
who would want to deal with
worried.
That.
Yeah. But the other part of it, you know, the falling asleep thing is interesting. In as much as I think he is losing sleep over this, I think the bubble that he lives in, and he's got, you know, there's basically two Trump bubbles. There's the bubble of the, you know, like the fake election where I think he really believes he was robbed of an election, but. You know, he's also been able to convince half the country that, you know, it was a stolen election or a good portion of it. And then there's the other bubble that Trump lives in that he tries to create when he says things like, there's a consensus growing around 15 weeks for abortion. That's just not true. But I think he feels if I say things like that, people will believe it. And we have to go to break.
We have to take a break. We'll come right back to you right after this. News from the BBC, and we'll continue right after this.
It's a vicious cycle.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and our panel discussion. Fred Hoff, Jim Ketterer, Jay Jochnowitz, and Judy Patrick make up the group. I'm Joe Donahue. It's 34 minutes past 9 o'clock. We are talking about Donald Trump's criminal trial in Manhattan. No jurors picked yesterday. Jay was in the middle of his remarks when we had to break for news, but I'm hoping you can continue.
I think I can reconstruct it. We were talking about the his falling asleep and the bubbles that he exists in, and you know, essentially, I think what's happened in recent months is that Donald Trump, bubbles are kind of bursting all around him, and they're doing it particularly in courts of law. He lost the E. Jean Carroll case, and he's on the hook for $84 million. And he lost the fraud case that the attorney general brought against him, and he's on the hook for $460-something million. And everywhere he's turning, he's finding that the court system is treating him like a defendant. Whether it's a civil defendant or in this case a criminal defendant, he got a few reminders of that, very stark ones in this trial, just in the last few days, where the judge said, "No, you can't go to Washington to go listen to the Supreme Court on a case you don't have to by law be at, but by law you have to be in my courtroom, and so you're going to be in my courtroom." And he's just learning you can't go to your son's graduation. Next month, we're not going to play that game. You know, we're not going to play these games to delay things. And I think it's hitting home for him that he could come out of this trial. He could be exonerated, no question. But I think it's also hitting home for him that he could come out of this trial with a criminal conviction. And then where that goes, the one thing he is certain of at this point is it's not a game anymore. And he's out of control. He's not in control. Well, he's out of control, but more importantly, he's not in control. The judge is in control.
And either way, I mean, it'll prove to be beneficial money wise in bringing in campaign contributions. Mm-hmm. But what does that mean? I assume then you appeal and then we're back to the races, right?
But he's also looking at the big money. To catch up with Biden, there was a story about that as well. That little donations. He's drained his little donors, I think, and he's trying to catch up to Biden with big donors. And I'm not sure that big donors are quite as
gullible.
Gullible, yeah, that's the word. there's a few out there. I think my pillow guy probably is one of them. But I'm not so sure the well is going to dry. The big wells are going to dry up, or some of them anyway.
Jim?
Well, since the theme so far has been sleeping in courtrooms, I was on jury duty last summer, and it was really fascinating to be part of the jury selection process. And near the beginning of the process, one person announced that they had narcolepsy and therefore they couldn't be on the jury. And so they were dismissed. And then several other people said, "Oh, wait, I have narcolepsy too." And
I want to see a doctor's note.
Yeah. They were dismissed also. And I had the distinct feeling, the judge didn't say it, but I had the distinct feeling that the judge was thinking, they might be honest, they might not be honest about this, but if they're not honest about this, I don't want them on this trial. Right. It was a very tough and sensitive trial. And it was interesting to see the process by which it's winnowed down. I think selecting a jury for this case, it just started because I think there's really no political middle left in the country, and people have either decided they're all for him or they're all against him politically. So how that overlaps into being impartial in terms of a criminal proceeding, I think that's a very tough thing. Mm. And then the safety of the jurors once the trial starts. I mean, we have seen, you know, real, very serious threats against all kinds of people, secretaries of state and states who oversee elections and people who are election workers and on and on and on. And I think no matter what is done to probably protect the identities of the jurors, they're likely to really be in the bullseye. And I think they're going to be doing their civic duty and more. I also just want to follow up on one thing that Judy said and Jay alluded to as well, and the idea that he might be exonerated and that, you know, there are many people who oppose Donald Trump who are really hoping that this is the way we can rid him of the body politic. And I think that's I think the criminal justice process should take its course and let the chips fall where they may. But in terms of the health of our political institutions, I think counting on the courts to do political work is a mistake. And I think if we want to have an election that is seen as legitimate and that doesn't send the country down a very dangerous road of post-election day violence, I think we need to see an election where one person wins clearly and the other person doesn't, and let those chips fall where they may. Because
Well, we had that 4 years ago and it didn't work.
Yeah, but we have to have it again. And I think to have the courts intercede, you know, I've seen this kind of game played out. And I say game in terms of the politics of it, and I'm not commenting on the court, but I've seen it played out in other countries, particularly in African countries, where candidates are bounced off the ballot. Now, this was even the case in Egypt when I was living there many years ago for the first elections after the revolution. And it delegitimizes the ultimate outcome of the election one way or another. And so as much as opponents of Trump might be waiting with bated breath for one or many of these cases to somehow take him out of the election or to tarnish him so much that he's not a viable candidate anymore, I'm sure there's going to be many people who write in and disagree with me, but I just don't think that's healthy for our election process.
I agree with you, but what's the alternative? I mean, yeah. when you're dealing with politicians, yeah. when you're dealing with politics, this is going to sound snarky, and I guess it is, but you know, if you want to avoid it, then don't have would-be felons run for president.
Right. I'm not saying that he shouldn't be standing trial. I do think that he should be treated as every other citizen, and he should have to stand trial for those things for which he's accused. And so there is no way out of it. But I'm just saying in terms of the politics, the ripple effect of the politics that come from this, if people want to see this as the major victory, I think they ought to be very, very cautious about it because I've seen it play out in other places, and it's not the victory that people are hoping for. There will be real implications from it. Right. And I think, you know, could be potentially really difficult implications even throughout the process as it overlaps with the campaign season.
And then the question becomes, which system, the legitimacy of which system is more important? The
right.
legitimacy of your election system in the eyes of the people or the legitimacy of your justice system in the eyes of the people?
Right. I mean, and, you know, we have another case that's taking some dramatic turns where the Supreme Court is going to hear arguments on whether or not the Sarbanes-Oxley law is going to be applicable to Trump on the January 6th incitement case. And if so, for those who oppose Donald Trump, if for constitutional reasons or for other legal reasons that law is no longer seen as applicable to his case and he's seen as getting off the hook, will people say, well, that you know, that's just as disappointing as the Mueller investigation and all these other things. I just think that whatever, let the criminal process take its course. But people who want to see Donald Trump lose need to marshal their resources to make sure that happens in November, and not count on the courts one way or the other.
So if I had to write the cliff notes on your answer.
Good luck.
We're screwed no matter what happens.
Yeah, but maybe you could put that in a limerick or something to make it more entertaining.
Fred.
Yeah, I'm glad the word legitimacy has come up several times in this conversation, because this really is the key issue. Over the past few years, we've seen a frontal attack on the legitimacy of our political system. You know, this allegation that somehow the 2020 election was stolen, you know, notwithstanding people going 0 for 61 or 0 for 62 in court cases related to this. There was a dress rehearsal over a decade ago when Mr. Trump led the attack on President Obama, the birther controversy that Obama was not eligible to be a citizen of the United States and therefore was not legitimately serving as president of the United States. This is extraordinarily important, and I'm sure, you know, Vladimir Putin and the Kremlin is celebrating it every day. I mean, how could he have ever imagined that a former president and a candidate for the presidency would actually be leading an all-out attack on the legitimacy of the American system. As far as the trial is concerned, I was a bit, I guess the thing I noticed most, and it took me aback a little bit, was the fact that over 50% of the potential jurors said that they would not be able to be fair and impartial. I don't get that. I realize a number of them probably just wanted nothing to do with the process and raised their hands. But look, as Jim mentioned, everybody in this country has an opinion about Donald Trump, positive or negative. What does that have to do with our duty as citizens to sit on a jury, put that sort of thing aside, and decide whether or not the government has proven its case?
Boy,
that's the job.
I would like to think that I could do that job, but I think for a lot of people the hatred runs very deep, and you just don't think you could be impartial.
Well, you know, I've just said some fairly harsh things. I've accused Mr. Trump of leading an attack on the legitimacy of our political system. But I'm quite certain I could sit on a jury and render a judgment in this specific case as to whether or not the government has made the case. That's what our system, that's what our judicial system is all about. And, you know, this is our duty as citizens. And, you know, seeing people just, you know, take a bye on this is just, I guess, another symptom of a broader problem we're facing in this country when it comes to civics.
That's a great point. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.
If you were there already.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Years ago, I was on a jury, and I went to the jury pool, and the attorneys and the judge were asking questions, and they said, do you know about this case? And as a journalist, I did. I knew about the case. Do you know the district attorney? Yes, I know the district attorney. Do you know the lawyer? Yes. Do you know the judge? Yeah, I do. And they said, all right, well, would you be able to be impartial and fair with that? And I said, yeah, I would be. Mm-hmm. And then they said, is there anything else we should be aware of? And I said, you just made my mother-in-law foreman of the jury. And they said...
Dismissed.
Can you? No, they didn't. No, they did not. No, they again went with the can you be impartial? And once it was explained to me that I had to be impartial to the case and not to my mother-in-law, it worked out fine. But I just couldn't believe that that happened.
So you ended up serving
God,
on
yes.
that jury.
Oh yeah, yeah. Wow. And I'll go with Jim. I call that one of the great learning experiences of yeah. my life. If you have never served on a jury, it is one of the most fascinating. I mean, it's a pain. Like you're there. It's they're herding cats. It's a lot, but it is fascinating.
Was
the
this
process is fascinating.
Was this Philadelphia mother-in-law no. justice or was this up here?
No, this was North Country justice.
I agree. I think that. If you get the opportunity to be on a jury, you really shouldn't claim that you have narcolepsy and walk out the door. You really should do it because, number one, as Fred said, it's your civic duty, and it's how our system works. And as Joe said, it's a fascinating insight into a part of our institutional processes that you probably wouldn't otherwise see. I was on a trial jury once, and I was on grand jury yeah. one time for multiple weeks, one day a week, and we were, you know, had multiple cases each day that were deciding to indict or not, and both were fascinating experiences.
Because you get to the end of the case, and you look at your watch, and you say, oh, we should wrap this up. Once we go into deliberations, this won't take long. And then they take like the first informal poll, and nine people say not guilty. And you're like, wow, okay, man. And then you start going through it. It's just fascinating.
Yeah, and I have to say that in our deliberation process, the initial result of the vote was split, evenly split.
Yep.
And the deliberations were interesting, they were intense, but they were very civil. And I left the whole process feeling much better about our institutions than I normally do when I come on the round table. I mean, I really thought that it worked as it should have worked.
Will you be discussing the case outside of the courtroom? Well, my mother-in-law is going to be driving me home. So unless we get a book on tape...
I had the judge ask me in the jury that I did serve on for all of like 10 minutes because they settled. They took a break and then they settled, and that was the end of my jury duty. And it was I was fascinated by it. But the judge was going through the jurors. He said, let me speed this up. And he started to ask questions before the lawyers did. And he got to me and he said, Mr. Jockner, can I count on you not to go back to your office and read all about this case? And I said, absolutely, Your Honor. If you tell me not to, I won't. And he said, do you feel you can? And he went through the questions.
Right.
And I said, absolutely. And I stayed on the jury. Second jury, I knew the prosecutors, and not in a good way. And he didn't even get to the question. He just looked. He saw Carol DeMar, another reporter, and me sitting in the back of the room. And he said, this was hours into the jury selection. He said, you two, leave.
Yeah.
And that was it.
Right. But they do, and I think this was brought up, I don't know if it was brought up during the break or on air, but they tell you the rules, they tell you what you need to know, what you don't need to know, and it's fascinating because you're in this room and you really, there's a lot you don't know. And so we'll see. My other take on this too, and then we'll get to our letters, is that... again, with my limited familial jury experience, is that picking the first couple takes forever, and then after a while, they're just like, okay, you know, and it goes a lot faster toward as it grinds on, and so today may be a little bit more, today or tomorrow may be a little bit more. Productive, let's say. While it's honorable to think that people can take 6 to 8 weeks out of their lives to serve on the jury, there's the issue of possibly being doxxed, threatened by supporters, all the while being given $40 a day for the privilege. Many employers don't find the concept of civic duty nearly as thrilling when their employee ends up going missing for weeks at a time. I mean, the law's on your side there, of course, but it still can be uncomfortable and difficult, and God forbid you work for yourself.
You know, that's absolutely right. It can be difficult, and I think, you know, employers need to adopt a different attitude toward this and also toward military reserve duty, which is often resented by employers who seem to have no idea of who's defending this country.
Nobody I know, writes Richard, is counting on this case to be the biggest victory should Trump lose. No one will lay down their vehemence or advocacy for getting out the vote. The hope is that this verdict might make for a more decisive victory for Democrats in November, because close elections make people crazy. That from Richard.
There's actually been polls on this issue that people will say, would you be more likely to not vote for Donald Trump if he's been convicted of any of these crimes? And a significant percentage, not of Republicans but of independents, will say that would change their feeling about who they would vote for, and that could be a crucial number of voters in key battleground states.
But I think the flip side to that is that it will further inspire his committed base to stay with him and to turn out. And that has been his model of success so far, is that he's able to keep the base together and he gets them to turn out in extraordinary numbers.
But it's a limited base. It's not growing.
We go to Jennifer, who says, it isn't that I couldn't be fair-minded with the court facts. I wouldn't want to be a juror because I know I would be harassed. Then Peter makes a really good point, I think. Trump is not a normal candidate, nor was he a normal president. To count on the normalcy of democracy to take care of him is foolish. Letting things take their course has not worked at any point. Why do you think it will work now?
That's a very dangerous statement. Yeah. It really is, because
I mean, it's a dangerous statement, but you understand where it comes from.
I do understand where it comes from, but I also understand where it goes and where it leads us. Because if you're saying that the normalcy of democracy simply can't work, that the processes are no longer legitimate enough, then you're basically saying the same thing that Trump is saying. It's all rigged. You can't trust the results unless I win, of course. And that kind of thinking, I think, will end up in absolute disaster after Election Day in November. On either side of the equation, that kind of thinking is really, I've seen it happen before. People have, I think most Americans have no idea how bad it can really get. And they ought to take a look at across the Balkans in the 1990s and multiple other cases. This, I'm not kidding, this really could get very serious. And so I think that particular sentiment is more than unfortunate.
And it's a sentiment that essentially validates what Donald Trump is trying to achieve in his attack on American political legitimacy.
There was I was flipping around stations this morning and listening to conservative radio, and I'm not sure if this is a trend or not, but what leaped out at me was how one caller introduced his talk about the next election. He said, if the next election is rigged and they put the same people back in power, if the next election is rigged again and we end up with the same people in power, that's a very different statement than if Joe Biden wins the next election. Right. And if that's what you believe, that this is the either or, that either the election is rigged or Donald Trump gets a second term, that is the problem. I mean, half the country does believe the system is illegitimate if they don't get their way. Or I say half, but it's 47%.
Yeah, we used to have a strong tendency in this country to downgrade sore losers. I wonder where that went.
I've used that term more than once in editorials and columns, and it just doesn't seem to resonate with people.
No.
He's a sore loser.
Bart writes, this simply parallels the unwillingness of so many American, quote-unquote, citizens to pull themselves away from their TVs and their phones, and make an effort to be informed and consider the needs of others and our country and anyone except themselves.
Good. Amen. Point. Amen.
Let's see. Tom writes, so we let SCOTUS decide January 6th. Clarence Thomas's wife was involved, and he doesn't see a semblance of impropriety where he should recuse himself. That leaves SCOTUS without credibility in my book. Let the people's vote decide the politics. Getting back to an earlier issue that we discussed. Let's see, two letters. John writes, but aren't the people being negatively affected by the Trump legal situation the same ones who voted him into office? And then Sheila writes, Judy, you're right to point out the discrepancy in pay between the NBA and the WNBA. But have you supported the cause by actually attending a WNBA game? Caitlin Clark should absolutely be paid the same as a top NBA draft pick. But please remember, the WNBA also needs more of us to show up at games and support the growth of the sport as a whole. Please go to a game. It's fun for the entire family. My understanding is the two closest WNBA teams are in Brooklyn at Barclays, and the other one's at the Mohegan Sun. Those are the two closest places to us with a WNBA game.
You know, hats off to you, Joe, for knowing that. And one of my points was the fact that it was such a huge discrepancy. It's like, if it had been $200,000, I wouldn't have been aghast as severely as I was last night when I saw the $76,000. It was just, I understand the sport's growing and that it doesn't attract the viewership that the NBA does, but it's growing and the gains already have been substantial. It needs to be recognized.
It does need to be recognized. And I mean, anyone looking at the audience that the women's tournament in the NCAA had, as well as even the draft, which is boring, but people watched it in record numbers. So, as I said, somebody's making money. All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have much more to discuss. We welcome you. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable. Listening to the music of Katy Pruitt from the new album Mantras. And you can see the entire list of songs played throughout the panel this morning by going to the playlist that is posted online, WAMC.org/roundtable. WAMC.org/roundtable. All right. Let's talk about Iran's attack on Israel. Of course, we spoke about this yesterday at length, and we want to further discuss it in this morning's program. An article in the New York Times, for Israel's allies, Iranian missile strike scrambles debate over Gaza. 2 weeks ago, the Prime Minister of Britain was facing a chorus of calls to cut off arms shipments to Israel because of its devastating war in Gaza. On Monday, the Prime Minister saluted the British warplanes that had shot down several Iranian drones as part of a successful campaign to thwart Iran's attack on Israel. It was a telling example of how the clash between Israel and Iran has scrambled the equation in the Middle East. Faced with a barrage of Iranian missiles, Britain, the United States, France, and others rushed to Israel's aid. They set aside their anger over Gaza to defend it from a country they view as an arch nemesis, even as they pleaded for restraint in Israel's response to the Iranian assault. Fred.
You know, what struck me even before the Iranian attacks were launched on Saturday, what really struck me was the apparent lack of Iranian operational security in the lead-up to this attack. The U.S. government was announcing publicly that Iran shouldn't do it. It kind of reminded me of the immediate lead-up to the Ukraine invasion. when we were when the U.S. was going public. I mean, we had this was mostly a product of our intelligence community, which had the capability of understanding what the Russians were really up to. I assumed that this might have been the case in the lead up to the Iranian attack. But we know now there was very little in the way of operational security on the part of the Iranians in the lead up to the attack. 72 hours beforehand, they were telling neighboring countries that we're going to be crossing your airspace. I mean, surely the Iranians understood that Israel and its partners were going to be prepared when this attack was launched. You know, so in essence, Iran put on a big show, something on the order of 320 systems, 300 drones and missiles flying toward Israel. There's a 600-mile gap, so many of the drones could be intercepted. But the Iranians seem to be intent on putting on the show without necessarily creating significant casualties or significant damage on the ground. Now, I realize American officials have said at the Security Council and elsewhere that that Iran really did intend to create something of a massacre inside Israel. But I just don't see that as consistent with the way the Iranians handled the lead up to this operation. They made little or no attempt to maintain secrecy, to maintain any possibility of tactical surprise in this attack. So now Israel has a tough decision to make. It's understandable that the Israelis want to restore a sense of deterrence. This is the first time in history that Iran has directly attacked Israel. It's used Hezbollah and others in the past. And, the Israelis are under a lot of pressure from the United States not to do something so spectacular that it introduces another escalatory chain, perhaps leading to a broader war. When I think of the kinds of things Israel can do, one possibility would be to create sonic booms over Iranian cities. This would depend, of course, on an assessment of Iranian anti-aircraft capabilities. There can be a military response that's not necessarily overly lethal. I doubt that Prime Minister Netanyahu wants to defy the President of the United States on this. And as some of Netanyahu's reluctant war cabinet partners have pointed out, there's a diplomatic upside to this for Israel. It can revive discussions having to do with the eventual normalization of Saudi Arabia and others with the Jewish state. In the end, however, I think those possibilities, which can be kept alive by a somewhat moderate Israeli response, those possibilities will depend on a resolution of the situation in Gaza and the perception of other Arab states that there is indeed a clear pathway toward Palestinian self-determination.
Jim?
Yeah, I agree with Fred. I think this was an entirely intentional lack of operational security and telegraphing, and that this attack, though these are real weapons with real potential consequences, was performative in a way and was in direct response to the Israeli attack on Iranian facilities in Syria that resulted in the death of 11 people. The Iranians say some diplomats and also some military leaders, the head of the Al-Quds force and part of the Revolutionary Guard Corps. Whether those were diplomatic facilities or not is in dispute, but that's the Iranian perspective on this. But the fact that the Iranians basically said that the operation was over while there were still weapons in the air, I think speaks volumes about their desire to have this be performative, but also be a moment of maybe lead to a moment of de-escalation. I don't think it's going to at all lead to a moment of, you know, really bringing the kind of conflicts that have been going on for many, many years to an end. I think it will just bring it back within the guardrails of what we've been seeing, these tit-for-tat attacks on each other. Most of the weapons that were launched from Iran proper, but not all of them. Some came from Syria, some from Iraq, and some from Yemen. But interestingly, none from Lebanon. And I think that was intentional because that also would have opened the door for Israel to carry out all kinds of attacks in Lebanon that I think both sides and also the United States would see as the real potential for not only be massively destabilizing, but also escalatory. So I think Fred is right that you're going to see the Israelis respond in some way. I can remember many times being in Lebanon when there were the sonic boom runs of the Israelis, and it's not a minor thing. I mean, it gets people's attention, right, and it sends a message. So if it's kept in that, I think it will send the signal that we're still going to be, we, the Israelis and the Iranians, we're still going to be at each other, but we're going to bring it back within the guardrails of the tit-for-tat that existed before. The U.S., interestingly, you know, is finding ways to talk to the Iranians through the good offices of the Swiss and the Omanis. And, of course, they're talking directly to Netanyahu and his government. I think the wild card, though, on both sides, is that the hardliners are ascendant in Iran, and there are real hardliners in Netanyahu's government in Israel. And so, you know, to ripple effects and Gaza and other things, the hardliners still have to be dealt with and managed. And I think the performative part of the Iranian attack over the weekend was not only a performance for the world, but for domestic consumption in Iran as well.
Yeah, I think more than anything, it was for domestic consumption. And I would agree with you. It seemed very performative. You know, the question now, it was interesting that I thought the one thing that fell flat in the performance was that they created sympathy for Israel. From people who, you know, certainly not, you know, people who are anti-Zionist to begin with aren't going to be moved by this. But people who are in the middle, who have just been, you know, kind of where a lot of moderates are in the United States, I think, which is really uncomfortable with not having this be black and white. You know, I wish I could say this or that is good and this is bad. But there's so much, you know, nuance to all this that it just becomes it becomes hard to get your head around. And then when something like this happens, you say, all right, Israel's under attack. That I can figure out, and that shouldn't have happened. So, you know, and I'm relieved that they weren't harmed. So there's goodwill here, and to squander that, which is what I do fear Netanyahu's going to do, would be a real mistake. You know, there's talk of Rafah now, that they're gearing up for to return there. To go there and begin an operation of some kind when, you know, you've got all these people displaced in the north and on the verge of, if not in, a famine. This is a moment for Israel to just recalibrate the whole situation, if that's even possible with Netanyahu and his coalition. I don't know. I do not have a crystal ball on this one.
You know, we talk about what Iran did as performative. Now we have to see what Israel do, how performative that is, and whether or not that will lead to a real escalation. One of the things, from a common sense American perspective, I look at this and say they're playing a very dangerous chess game, and they've been playing it for decades. And what is the Biden administration's path forward in terms of what is our policy about dealing with these issues in the Middle East? Not to escalate it, I understand it, but we've never really resolved the nuclear issue in Iran. That seems to be an escalating problem. That deal was scuttled by Trump. It seems to be portions of it are expiring. As a common sense perspective, I want to see things de-escalate in the Middle East, but I also want to see us move away from the idea of the tit for tat, because that's been going on for too long. And we talk about, oh, there's only one casualty. Well, one casualty is one casualty, in my mind, too many. I would love to see the President of the United States at this point come forward and give a national speech. Tell us what's going on and what he's doing to address it. I understand from a diplomatic perspective, a lot of things have to be said, understated and back channels. But I'm left just wondering what's happening in the Middle East.
Anybody else?
I just want to mention one thing, too. Sorry, Jay, okay. About Jordan and the role of Jordan in this that highlights, I think, a broader problem across the region. So Jordan was involved, and they shot down one or more of the Iranian weapons that were coming across their territory. And the Jordanian government is in a very difficult position, because in the wake of doing this, they are also encountering a lot of blowback from across the region, but also from their own people. And it's just a sign of this rising tide of anger across the region about Israeli actions in Gaza. And then, anything that a government might do in the region that is seen as somehow being supportive and defensive of Israel and defending Israel is seen as highly problematic, to put it mildly. I also saw an Iranian government statement that beforehand had even said specifically to Jordan, if you do anything, you're next, basically. And that concerns me a lot. Jordan has been the site of serious attacks, some recently and some major ones a few years ago. So I think that, in terms of what happens next, one of the things that I'm concerned about is what kind of price politically and what kind of price in terms of security that Jordan might pay.
When I want to just look at another aspect of this before our break at the bottom of the hour, and this on Ukraine, when Iran unleashed hundreds of deadly missiles and drones at Israel this weekend, Israelis relied on a crucial tool that Ukraine still does not have: instant direct assistance from the United States and other partners with military assets in the region. For more than 2 years, Ukraine has faced Russian missile and drone attacks, often including Iranian-made drones like the ones Tehran used on Saturday. As a shield, Ukraine relies on a hodgepodge of air defense systems provided by Western partners, including three U.S.-designed Patriot batteries manned by Ukrainian troops. This month, the biggest power station serving Kyiv was destroyed. Civilian casualties are common. So the question with Ukraine watching, why does Ukraine feel so alone, Fred?
Well, Ukraine feels alone, I think, in the first instance, because Ukraine has witnessed the response of the United States and its partners to the attack on Israel. Ukraine is in a perilous situation right now. The Russians have settled into a pattern of using the same kind of mix that the Iranians have used that they used in targeting Israel, a mix of drones, cruise missiles, and ballistic missiles, now being aimed at Ukrainian infrastructure and particularly energy infrastructure. The geographical disadvantage the Ukrainians have is that some of these systems are actually launched from occupied Ukrainian territory. The Ukrainians don't have the time that Israel had to react to these kinds of attacks. But the real problem is that Ukraine lacks adequate air defense systems and fighter jets capable of shooting down a lot of this stuff as it enters the airspace. Vladimir Putin is counting on the United States to fail in its support of Ukraine. He is counting on us to drop it entirely. He's counting on us to elect to office people who really don't care about this situation and who are in fact favorably disposed toward him, Vladimir Putin. It's encouraging that the Speaker of the House is now taking steps to move things forward. But the longer we wait, the more difficult it will be for Ukraine to defend anything of value in the country.
Jim?
Judy had mentioned before having President Biden address the nation. I think you were speaking specifically about the Iran-Israel question. And I know that the president has talked about the Ukraine situation, but I think that it needs to be talked about again and in more specifics, and not just by the president. Just to say that while this is important for our security and leave it at that is not a convincing argument. And I think increasingly, now that we're 2 years into this, Americans need to know why and how specifically is it relevant to our security. Now, I would hope that some of this would come out in campaign season, but who knows how much foreign policy really is going to matter in this or really in any campaign. It doesn't matter enough, in my estimation. But I also think every member of Congress should be asked about it or should be talking about it. I mean, I think those who oppose continued funding are certainly talking about it, and they have their talking points. But I think there needs to be a more detailed and serious conversation about what is at stake for the United States in this. Because absent of that, I think we're just going to slowly, through the vagaries of our own institutional paralysis, check out the and all the things that Fred said are certainly true. The other thing is that the Ukrainians are also running out of Ukrainians who are going to serve, and you see, you know, them trying to adjust the draft age, and you see reports of more people fleeing the country so as not to be drafted. It's going in a very grim direction, and up to this point, the U.S. and allies have been, you know, not wanting to give the highest tech equipment to the Ukrainians for fear that they would use it all to attack Russia proper. But I think, you know, it's getting to a pretty desperate point now.
Let's hold there. We'll hear from our other panelists on the other side of the break. Real quick, we were talking earlier about the campaign and Trump. And this came out of an answer that Jim Ketterer gave, and I said basically the cliff notes being that we're screwed, and Jim said, well, maybe we could come up with a limerick. Dara wrote us a limerick. A candidate both crass and lewd, narcissistic and stupid and crude, is up for election, whichever selection, won't matter, we're totally screwed. Thank you, Dara. We will take a break. When we come back, we'll
thank
continue
you, Jim.
Our conversation after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable. Our last go-around with this terrific panel this morning, Fred Hoff, Jim Ketterer, Jay Jochnowitz, and Judy Patrick make up the wonderful panel, and we welcome you and your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We were talking about Ukraine and sort of watching the U.S. coalition protect Israel and feeling kind of lonely in that process, an article from the Washington Post that I read from earlier. Jay?
I'm as optimistic as I am more optimistic than I have been for months about the prospects of the United States actually giving Ukraine aid. It fascinates me that Johnson's talking about doing this right after a meeting with Trump at Mar-a-Lago. I think a number of things were discussed there, and I don't think he'd be doing this unless Trump said, yeah, go ahead and do it. And I think that he might even be feeling Johnson might be feeling the pressure of being responsible for a country collapsing after all this time, because of people like Marjorie Taylor Greene and Matt Gaetz and the rest of the bunch over there. So that's encouraging that he's gone this far. I don't think he would risk his speakership and everything else. I don't think he would risk a no vote on this. And he structured it in a way that I think is palatable, hopefully, for enough people. And then the Democrats are certainly going to come over on it and join him. And, you know, the politics will be what the politics will be. And I think we'll see it very quickly this week.
It seems to be, yeah.
Yeah. I'm not optimistic about Congress very much. This is one week I'm optimistic.
Well, we'll see.
Yeah,
right. I agree with Jay about I have a little bit of optimism here. But can I also note that they're talking about they're going on recess at the end of this week? Didn't they just have a recess? I mean, how often does that group recess? It seems way too much. Also, I wanted to note that Zelensky, the Ukrainian president, is so good on social media. As soon as Israel came under attack, he was on Twitter or what we X or whatever, talking about, you know, how his country has suffered the same kind of attack without the same kind of coordinated response from allies that Israel is getting. He does a great job with that. We really do need to make the point to the American public about how important Europe is and how important sustaining democracies are. I think I've mentioned before, I went to New Orleans and the World War II Museum. Just walk through that place and you understand why European safety is our safety, why we're an important cog in the global peace. That's what one of our roles has been. We rose to the challenge in World War II. We need to keep that in mind. I think younger generations don't. I am a little concerned, though Marjorie Taylor Greene's motion to vacate a Kentucky congressman this morning came out and said he is in support of this motion. I don't think it'll go anywhere. I agree with Jay that the fact that this is all happening after, you know, Johnson made the trip to Mar-a-Lago, he must have some tacit approval from Trump to move forward with this, and Trump may have calculated that letting Ukraine fall would be bad for his campaign.
Yeah. Anybody else? All right. I just want to go back a little bit, and because we're talking about Ukraine, we're talking about Israel. As far as initially in the attack, and I read the press release from Elise Stefanik yesterday on the air about her within minutes of the. Of the attacks of going after Biden. In our conversations, how does this impact Biden and the relationship with our allies too? But most importantly, I think, well, I mean, not most importantly, but for the purposes of my question, of the politics of it for someone who has been receiving tremendous flack on this issue.
Yeah, I think, Joe, unfortunately, it's way too early to tell how this is going to work out politically. Right now, the important measures are in the hands of the Israelis. I mean, what are they actually going to do? Is it possible that there could be a diplomatic opportunity here that the president could take advantage of that leads to the termination of armed conflict in the Gaza Strip and the resumption of a move toward unity in the region against Iran and its puppets? if President Biden can contribute successfully to that kind of a development, I think it will be very much in his favor. And let me just add a couple of words about the idea of deterrence in all of this, both on the Ukrainian front and in the Middle East. Deterrence essentially is in the mind of one's adversary, and that's where it either works or doesn't work. For the better part of 40 years, Iran has calculated that what the United States wants to do more than anything else is avoid a major war in the Middle East. And indeed, we want to avoid a major war in the Middle East, and I'm not advocating a major war in the Middle East. But to have this foremost in the mind of one's adversary is potentially very, 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 very destabilizing. I mean, Vladimir Putin concluded after our red line collapse in 2013, after the use the Syrian regime's use of chemical weapons, that he had nothing to worry about from the United States. 2014, he took Crimea. 2022, he invaded Ukraine. And when he made the decision in 2022, he had every reason to believe that all the United States would do is wring its hands in the UN Security Council and make speeches of outrage. He turned out to be wrong. But my point is, if one's opponent has the perception that the United States wishes more than anything else in the world to avoid armed conflict, that's a recipe for real instability. And I've seen it going all the way back to 1983, when I was on a Department of Defense board investigating the bombing of the U.S. Marine Corps headquarters at Beirut International Airport. We knew from our investigation that the Iranians had orchestrated, had commanded the whole thing. And yet the Reagan administration chose to write this off as a random act of terrorism rather than what it was, which was Pearl Harbor in the Middle East.
Anybody else?
I just want to say also that I think we see this situation highlighting Biden's relationship with the various wings of the Democratic Party. And so you still have, you know, the very progressive wings clamoring for a ceasefire and clamoring for the U.S. to get tough with Israel on its prosecuting of the conflict in Gaza. At the same time, you now see Senator Fetterman from Pennsylvania coming out and criticizing President Biden for putting conditions on Israeli responses to Iran. And so as we get closer to November and Biden has to balance off these various forces within his own party, meanwhile, the Middle East is going to continue to present one challenge after another. It's going to be continue to be a very bumpy ride just within the Democratic Party.
One of the concerns I had that, and this is very speculative, but you know, you talk about what the appropriate response is when your sovereign territory for the first time is hit by an adversary. You know, the idea of sonic booms. I grew up with sonic booms, by the way. We lived near Grumman.
On
Long Island, and our next door neighbor was an Air Force pilot, and he would go out, you know, he'd go out in his leather jacket and his helmet and stuff, and all the kids in the neighborhood would be, "Mr. England, are you going to fly over the house and make it shake?" And he did. it was fun, but I digress. One of the concerns I had was that they would use this as an opportunity to strike some Iranian nuclear development facilities. At a time when, you know, the deal long ago collapsed. So what do you do with the fact that Iran is supposedly that much closer to, you know, breakout phase where they could develop a nuclear weapon much faster than they were able to before, and that they would allow Israel to kind of be the proxy for the West on this and say, go ahead, bomb something. I hope that's not the case, because I think that escalates.
But I would just say that the Israelis have attacked those facilities before, but not in that way. not yeah. with planes and not with missiles that were launched from Israel proper, but through clandestine activities. Some of them were very effective at destroying some important infrastructure.
And killing some important people.
And killing some important people. They've carried out assassinations as well. That, you know, as deadly and as nasty as that is back within the context of the previous tit-for-tat game that was happening up until a few weeks ago.
Yep.
All right. We have 2 minutes. Judy just mentioned this during the break, and I had not known about it prior, and apparently it just was released. But I thought we would I just wanted to mention it. We talked about this last week about the Yuri Berliner, senior editor at NPR, who wrote the argued that the network had lost America's trust and had a progressive mindset. And we learned today that this is from David Folkenflik of NPR, that he has been suspended as NPR grapples with his public criticism. It's a 5-day suspension without pay. It began last Friday and had not been previously reported. Yet the public radio network is grappling in other ways with the fallout from his essay. It angered many of his colleagues, led NPR leaders to announce monthly internal reviews of the network's coverage, and gave fresh ammunition to conservative and partisan Republican critics of NPR, including Donald Trump. So that is an interesting piece to this.
That's the last thing a newsroom wants to hear, is that upper management's going to start reviewing the stories they do. I mean, oh, God, it's like a nightmare.
The two editors in the room are tisking.
Well, it reminds me of, you know, what he talked about in the middle of it, where they were in the middle of the piece, where he was talking about, you know, doing audits. We also did things like that internally, where we were looking to make sure. And this is not a, you know, what's the word I want to use? This is not just some, you know, fad, touchy-feely thing. When you look to make sure that you are you're reflecting the diversity of your community. When you look at whether reporters' sources are diverse, whether they're going, you know, just going to the usual power people for their comments and stuff, or are they looking into neighborhoods and stuff? This is how you cover communities. This isn't some fad.
We're out of time.
I will cut it short.
That's all right. No worries. We'll talk about this again. Thank you all. We'll be right back.